Good stuff.
So I posted more PowerPoints up online. Keep it busy over spring break, you know, just in case you were bored. So the Endergreen chapters are at PowerPoint, and it's on Canvas as well under Files. And then it's also on your webpage, right? So what are we doing? We are here. So we're right here, right? 3:5, 3:7. So we'll try to get through the behavior chapter. It's not too heavy on content. There's a little bit of new stuff in there, but some of it can just kind of relax. Oh yeah, I know that, you know, but let it kind of sink in. And then we get into the endocrine chapter. And if you are really not, you know, doing anything over spring break, that's that intensive, it's a good time to actually catch up and look at those PowerPoints and read the chapters ahead. Endocrine has a lot of content, and this is the one part which I don't like so much, is that there's a lot of memory work. So endocrine, sometimes people have found that the easiest way is to make little note cards, flip through, write down the hormones, understand where their target of action is, and then, you know, where do they come from, how do they work, what do they do, and then maybe some interactions. Like usually there's kind of a yin-yang effect, you know, like with glucose, one hormone raises glucose levels in the blood and the other one lowers it down. So kind of think of the agonist, antagonist type of hormone. But there's a lot of content with the endocrine chapters. So try to catch up if you can, you know, on the beach while you're reading your book. The sun's so bright, you're getting sunburn, you know, not good, you get skin cancer. So go back in, study. That'll be it for you. Okay. All right. Anyways, the sun will reflect off the notes, and it's too hard to read, so it's better to read inside. Right, there you go. Try to convince you. So the quiz grades are posted and everything, and what to do tonight? The newspaper assignment, right? So try to get that in. You know, write up something. People that have kind of sent things in earlier, I've been able to bounce back, like you forgot to mention or forgot to put the reference in there. But if you're last minute, like 11:55, and I can't give you some feedback, right, if you miss something. So if you get it in a little bit earlier, I can at least make sure. Just go through that list and kind of check it off, and you should be good. Hopefully it's a buffer for grades, right? It's not something really difficult, but it's to get you used to writing something in layman's terms and then discuss something hopefully that you like. But like some people miss the quiz on Tuesday, even though we have it on the webpage, and that just, you know, hurts their grades, right? So if you don't do this, it's 10 points, right? So it's an easy 10 points. So try to make sure you do that. Okay, any questions, lab questions? You're writing, is something due tonight or tomorrow, right? Isn't it? I know, you're very busy. That's why I try to encourage you to get that lecture assignment done earlier so you don't have all that stress at one time. But I know it's hard to do. You've got other classes. Can't imagine anything but physiology in your mind, but it's okay. So some other questions with content. Somebody had a question about something, and I forgot what it was. They sent me an email. I was going to go over it today. Are they here? No, here? Yes. It was nicotine, right?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay, good idea. So, and it was with the lab.
Yeah.
So this is the frog neuromuscular junction. So the frog neuromuscular junction, this is a good point. So if you're doing some working on a lab rat, the frog neuromuscular junction is nicotinic, like our neuromuscular junction. So what does that mean? Nicotine binds to those receptors. They're cholinergic. Their acetylcholine is the normal neurotransmitter. But we divide up the acetylcholine receptors based on a pharmacology. And so they call them a certain group nicotinic, because nicotine activates those agonists, and then muscarinic receptors, but they both respond to acetylcholine. The muscarinic receptors, we'll talk about those when we get to cardiovascular systems, those are metabotropic. They work through second messenger cascades. The nicotinic receptor is an ion channel itself, so it opens up, and when acetylcholine binds to it, remember, those were the first receptors that were isolated from where? The electric organ of the fish that makes that electric field around them because it's such high concentration. So it was the first receptor that was crystallized, so they get three-dimensional structure. So it's an ion channel that opens up. It allows sodium to go in and potassium to come out. If we kind of remember back to the neuro stuff, its reversal potential is around zero millivolts. So that means if you open it up and you allow the ions to move across, it would bring that membrane up to zero. It doesn't bring up the E-sodium. It doesn't stay down here at E-potassium, but it's in between. So that means it's not a single ion going through that channel. It's a mix. So that'll go up to about E0 is the driving gradient if you have it open. But then they will close too. They inactivate. They desensitize to the acetylcholine. So when acetylcholine binds to it, they open up, but then they will go into a conformational closed state. And then they won't stay open. And the idea behind that is that now it'll have time for acetylcholine to come off, be cleaved by acetylcholine esterase, the enzyme in the synaptic cleft, and then acetylcholine, or the, we didn't go into it that in depth, but acetylcholine will be broken apart, and part of it goes back into the nerve terminal and gets repackaged and put back into the vesicle. So what does the acetylcholine esterase do? It helps to cleave, get rid of the acetylcholine in the synapse, which is in that inactivation of the acetylcholine receptor, that desensitization, allows the acetylcholine to go away from the synapse so it doesn't rebind. Otherwise, you could get rebinding phenomena, right? Acetylcholine could come up and rebind and then activate, even though you didn't activate the nervous system. So the idea behind that inactivation or desensitization of acetylcholine receptors is to allow the acetylcholine to clear the synaptic cleft. If you keep acetylcholine on, you just keep it on there, what's going to happen is, well, first you activate the receptors, right? They depolarize, but then they go into this desensitized state and you can't respond anymore. So the problem, like children, every year you hear about it, they might get into their mother, dad, or whoever, an adult's nicotine patches, and they put them all over them because they think they're stickers, right? And then they die. And the reason they die is that they had so much nicotine put into them, they desensitized those nicotinic receptors. And then when their nerves to their diaphragm or to their respiratory muscle, right, it's not functioning anymore, right? They can't breathe because it's not responding to the acetylcholine that's released from there. So they desensitized all their receptors, plus their heart's going crazy. And so this is the problem with those patches, too. They're very high concentration, and children every year die from nicotine patches. So it's something to watch out for, too. It's not something to play with, right? Is that answer it? Is that hit everything that we needed to know? Somebody else had a question on nicotine, too, right? So why, you maybe could get into that. Why is, there's also, we're going to hit that today, too, so that's interesting. It's a very into lecture where some other nicotinic receptors are in the sympathetic nervous system and how that can influence, say, heart rate, right? For example, even though you don't have nicotinic receptors on your heart, but it's within a circuit, right? So it's kind of interesting. Does that help? Something? Maybe? All right. Acetylcholine esterase is really interesting, too, because not only does your nerve make it and then put it out into the synapse and that matrix, but the muscle makes acetylcholine esterase, too. Isn't that wild? And it gets excreted out right there in that synapse. So it's in that matrix in the synaptic cleft. And it's very bizarre. I mean, the muscle makes it as well as the nerve makes it. And then that enzyme is in there to cleave out the acetylcholine. Right? So nerve gas agents, some of those are acetylcholine esterase inhibitors. They'll block acetylcholine esterase, so if you can't block acetylcholine esterase, what happens? Acetylcholine stays up high. It's like having too much nicotine around, right? And so it's the same kind of problem. So lots of insecticides are actually acetylcholine esterase inhibitors. So they'll say an esterase inhibitor. Some of them are voltage-gated sodium channels inhibitors, like tetrodotoxin kind of thing. Pyrethrin, if you ever look at the shelf in Kroger, and you look at the insecticides on the sprays, they'll probably say one's pyrethrin, and that's a sodium channel blocker, and the other one is an esterase blocker, and that's acetylcholine esterase. And that's why those are dangerous to spray around your kitchen, around your dishes and stuff if you see a cockroach, but they work on you too, so it's bad stuff. Okay, is that good? All right, that was a little tangent, but hopefully put it all in perspective. So this is where we left off, and oh my goodness, couldn't we just stay all day on this topic right here? It's just fantastic. All right, so that's your crayfish preparation, and so much history in this preparation. Even Sigmund Freud worked with a crustacean preparation, and he put methylene blue, a little stain, on the ganglion of the crayfish when they were dissecting them, and actually he saw it had relatively a simple nervous system. And he even thought that he could study social behavior in crayfish by understanding the nervous system. Well, that's wild. I'm glad he got out of that field and messed up psychology. He didn't mess up those too much. And so this is good. But what's really interesting is it's segmental, like we talked about the leech, you know, a segmental pattern. So it's a segmental structure. It's an arthropod. You know, arthropods, articulating appendages. All insects and crustaceans are underneath arthropods. But a lot of work in social behavior. If you put them together, you've probably seen how vicious they are when you pick them up and you try to do those dissections. If you put them together, they will make a social hierarchy. There are people that study that. There's a big group down at Georgia State in Atlanta that studies social hierarchy. There'll be one dominant and the other submissive. There's even, as you might have heard in ecology, the winner-loser effect. The one that keeps winning the battles will be more dominant. It's kind of like a bully in a schoolyard, right? And then you wonder, if you paired them all together, and you had the winner of this group and the winner of this group, and you pair them together, what happens? They actually will fight longer. So it's kind of interesting. But if you take that bully one, and you pinch on their claws, and all of a sudden they autotomize, because there's a special spot where they autotomize it off and will regenerate. As soon as you pinch it, they will become submissive. So something, you know, very quickly tells them, I don't have claws, I can't fight. I'm now submissive, even though they used to be dominant. So how does that work? You know, what's going on? And so that's kind of interesting. We'll talk about some more behaviors with them. So people have studied crayfish for a long time to understand social behaviors. There was a paper published back in the 1970s by Ed Kravitz from Harvard that actually injected serotonin into them and showed that, and he published it in Science, and showed that they raise their chelipeds up. And then he said, well, that's an aggressive stance. So actually the literature took off on that, and they said, oh, serotonin's related to aggression. But everybody came many years later, but a lot of references are still to that, even mammalian references, and realized that's not really true. And because the way that the study was done. So they inject serotonin at a very high level into the animal. It causes it to raise its chelipeds, but it tucks its tail under too. And it's stuck. It's catatonic. It can't really move. It's just like stuck in that position. So is that really aggression? You know, if you can't move and displace somebody from their shelter, for example, it's not true aggression. And then if you inject this other hormone called octopamine, they would drop their claws down and kind of just become flaccid on the bottom of the tank. So I said that's a submissive hormone. And that must be related to the aggressive and submissive behaviors. But how does that work so fast if you took the bully and you put them with the other bully and they fed it out, and then all of a sudden one has to become submissive, otherwise they'll kill each other. I mean, so one has to actually back down from the other one. So that's kind of interesting. Then does another hormone go up really quickly? Does it stay up all the time? Because if you stay serotonin high in the hemolymph, it will actually desensitize those receptors and downregulate them. So they'll be less responsive to serotonin. So a lot of controversy went on with the crayfish and lobster preparations. And then a paper came out that was really hilarious from a group down in Australia. They injected serotonin into an Australian crayfish, and they showed just the opposite behavior. It dropped its claws down, and they inject octopamine, and it would stand up. So people kind of joke in the field, it was hemispheric dependent, you know. So basically, you know, you can't jump on one paper that's published that needs really a lot of work to be done on that. And so actually, it's interesting that so much emphasis was put on a one paper that came out in Science, and then people have, you know, questioned a lot of that work later on. But it jumped into the mammalian literature, and they reference that related to humans. So that's kind of interesting too, right? And so they looked at humans with serotonin levels and wondered if it was higher or lower, like in prisoners, for example, things like that, aggressive people supposedly. And they really couldn't find the correlation. So because the serotonin in our blood isn't related with the serotonin so much that's in our brain, right? It comes from mast cells in our body as well. So interesting. I know we could go on so much. Remember we talked about the six abdominal ganglion being light sensitive even in cave crayfish without eyes? They have neurons in here that are light sensitive. Not only that, if you take away that and you record in these connectors up here with suction electrodes, you can show light sensitivity all the way up. But it's less and less light sensitive, but most light sensitive with the six abdominal ganglion. So people are still wondering why do they have it all throughout their abdominal ganglion, ganglia for light sensitivity. So kind of interesting. We could spend a lot of time with it. And we'll come back to this animal a little bit later. But the point is, segmental animal, ganglion controlling a segment, for example, and you see that throughout the animals as you work your way up from simpler animals to more complex animals. But that little brain up there can do so much, right? Olfactory cues, antenna cues, thinking about what it wants to do, food, all that kind of stuff, social hierarchy, and you just really wonder what's going on in that little brain and that connection. Okay, so the idea is that segmental animals with these segmental ganglion, and they can, you know, have reflexes within that segment, but then with a higher brain, then you can start to have more advanced functions, like take a quiz or a test in 350, right? So, pretty neat. But if you look at it throughout the animal, from simple animals like the little flatworm, you see again segments, you work your way up. From in crustaceans and insects, the same idea. Cephalopods are really quite interesting because you see these bigger ganglion, and then the brain is being more enlarged, right? So, you know, squid, octopi, pretty highly functional animals. They can, what is it that they guess the right bets on the games, right? Do you ever see that on YouTube, right? So I don't know if it worked out last year or not. And then we've talked about spinal cord reflexes before, and even in the lab that we went over, right, the outreach center, we did the vibration on your arm, right, in the Pinocchio nose experiment. But also another well-documented type of reflex that appears on standardized exams, that's that monosynaptic reflex, right, the patella reflex, the doctor, you hit your underneath your kneecap and your leg kicks out. That's a reflex that occurs within your spinal cord. But we do want to know the structure again, just to make sure that we all have that down. Remember, this is a cross-section through your spinal cord. These are dorsal horns, ventral horn. Dorsal horn is where sensory input comes in. That's your dorsal root ganglion right there. And if you, the idea with that reflex is that you are hitting that tendon underneath your patella, and you're stretching that muscle. And what you're stretching are the proprioceptors, all right? Just like what we talked about with the Pinocchio nose. And so you activate those, and then that can activate the motor neuron to then kick your leg out. And it's monosynaptic, so it happens very quickly. And it's just, and people time reflexes in other animals as well as humans to kind of get an idea of how many neurons are in an order for that response to occur. Because then you can think of synaptic delay that occurs throughout. The conduction's very fast. All right, so that's kind of interesting. Remember the ventral horn. And then all this blue matter that's here is really what we refer to as white matter, right? Where connectors are running up and down the spinal cord that are wrapped around with myelin, right? Okay, and just to kind of get you an idea about circuits, it's really interesting. You always think about a neuron to another nerve, right? Or a nerve to a muscle. But really, it's quite interesting. Think of your motor neurons, your alpha motor neurons that go to your extrafusal muscle. That's the big muscles, right? Not the interfusal, not your muscle spindles, but the alpha motor neurons actually go to two different types of targets. They go to a skeletal muscle, but they also have a collateral that goes over to another neuron. So here's a neuron that goes to a muscle as well as branching to a neuron. So it's kind of interesting in that sense, but this controls in your spinal cord, controls some feedback mechanisms in your spinal cord. This was why this is in your textbook, is that when they discovered this, it was a big news because nobody thought a neuron could go to two different types of targets, one muscle and another neuron, right? But not only that, they were learning about the circuits in your spinal cord to control motor activity. What's interesting about this is it goes over to this cell called the Renshaw cell, and that Renshaw cell, when it's activated, just like when your muscle is going to be activated, it actually inhibits back on the alpha motor neuron. So it's like a negative feedback, right? And here's a negative feedback type of circuit in your spinal cord. And what's really interesting is it's the neurotransmitter is glycine. And it hyperpolarizes the motor neuron. So it inhibits that motor neuron from continually firing if the activity is too high. So it's kind of it's interesting in that sense of this feedback mechanism. And then people did these night studies like to find out how that neuron actually works. They would inject into that cell a enzyme that kills that cell, like pronase, and it could kill that cell out and then see how that reflex has changed. And you could just get more of a continuous response. You wouldn't see that negative feedback process. So they realized this is very important in your body, and there's more work being done on this to try to control muscle spasticity, for example. If you could use agonists for this, think about controlling like restless leg syndrome and aspects like that. So a lot of people are trying to focus on this control of alpha motor neurons to understand more about regulation. All right, and we've already mentioned a lot about animal behavior. We talked about the digger wasp, for example, right? We talked about earlier, even Drosophila have that, if you give them a certain frequency, they'll start to roll. The little maggot will start to roll, right, the larvae, because that's the wing beat frequency of the parasitic wasp that they found out that could lay an egg inside of it. What would stimulate it is that same frequency. So some innate behavior, right, born with behavior. And we talked about already the fiddler crab that can change claw sizes, right? That it doesn't have that critical period. Remember, what if you had a question, what is critical period in neural development? How would you answer that, do you think? Critical period in neural development?
It's a period where if a certain stimulus isn't received, it will. If it's received outside of that period, it won't have the same effect.
Yes, that's basically it in the gist, thanks. So exactly, so that neural activity will no longer show plasticity, right? So it's that period, that critical period before that, where it could still be plastic, but after that, and then it's pretty much hardwired is the idea. So hardwired is a good way to think about it. And there might be a little bit of wiggle room, but basically those connections like your visual system, your hearing system, those connections in your brain have a critical period in development, normal development, and they have certain time periods for that. And then afterwards, there's not that plasticity. So you want to look at keeping the nervous system pretty active while it's forming those synapses and functioning. These kind of behaviors are really interesting because, like this cat showing an aggressive behavior because it's related to human behaviors too. You can take an electrode and put this in a certain spot in a dog or a cat, and they will become, and stimulate, and they will become vicious. I mean, they will attack anything that's in front of them, like a table or the wall or anything. So you wonder, is that system, that part in a human, if it was activated, or is that a reason that they might be so aggressive or responsive, right? Because you can instill that in other animals, in mammals. So there's a lot of interest. You can cut out areas in the brain called the amygdala, for example. It's an older system in our brain, evolutionarily, and it has for fear response. So you'll be fearful. You won't go walking off the ledge, right? You have fear. But if you destroy that in rodent brains, for example, or in dog brains or other animals, mammals, they don't fear. They don't have that fear anymore. So you kind of wonder about people that do crazy things that are not so fearful. Maybe their amygdala is a little messed up, right? You know, so who knows? But they'll walk on a platform and not be afraid of the edges, for example, where mice are afraid of that. They'll be skittish to walk out on a platform when they can't see the edges, for example. But if you destroy the amygdala, then it doesn't bother them. So it's kind of interesting understanding comparative aspects of the nervous system related with behavior. That's the focus of this chapter. And what those regions do, by comparative studies, we have a better understanding of that. We mentioned Conrad Lorenz. He did a lot of work with stickleback fish, for example, and looking at the stimuli and the response of the receiver and how they would respond. And he gave kind of the symbols like this, but not the real fish, just like, you know, drawings or models, and see how the other receiver would respond. You've probably seen the seagulls with the little red dot, you know, that's on the cheek of the mother, right? And the little babies will actually peck on that dot, and the mother will open the mouth and then give them the food. Well, you can even have a cardboard drawing of a mother with like the little dot there and put it in front of it, and the chicks will actually peck right at that dot. So it's not the mother, but it's something about that cue, that dot, that really makes the little ones peck just at that dot. So it's an innate behavior. They didn't learn it, right? So it's kind of interesting. But then you think about hardwired behaviors, right? So if you took the sensory nerves or motor nerves and you cross those in the spinal cord, coming out of the spinal cord, you cross the sensory nerves or the motor nerves with the other, like other leg, right? The animal doesn't learn to change that, right? So hardwired system. So the idea is it can't really redo those synapses very well. So this chapter has got a little bit of everything in it, but just to kind of rehash some of the things that we already covered. Remember the compound eye that we talked about? And it was on your quiz about edge detection and getting good contrast. What is that? Lateral inhibition, right? And so here's a good example of this. You give a steady light here, you can record this nerve, but if you give a different light or a stronger light, you can actually have the lateral inhibition to then inhibit, say, the neuron that was getting the lower level of light. So the idea is where the light's the strongest is where that signal's going to come in and then kind of dampen out the rest. For us, in our retina, that kind of activity and that all that complexity that's in the retina with amacrine cells and horizontal cells, that allows us to have good edge detection through lateral inhibition. All right, so what's interesting, too, is if you had time, there's a course, Comparative Neuroanatomy. You can pick up books on it, too. There's books out there. But pretty neat when you look at even the visual system across different animals. If you look at, like, a frog, for example, where the eyes are to the two sides and the visual fields don't overlap too much, right? But this side, the right side and the left side, how does that project to the brain compared to, say, a human with the eyes in front or a dog, for example? Well, what you see here is that the whole right field goes over to the left side in the brain, right? The optic tectum. And then just the opposite for the other side. So there's a complete crossing of the optic nerves here. Whereas in us, since our eyes are in front, but still, we only have partial crossing. And the rationale is we still have the full right visual field on our left part of our brain. Isn't that, that's kind of interesting to think about, you know, right? The way the brain's set up, where it crosses when the eyes are to each side, right? Get a full crossover. But then if it's in front of you, the left field is mixed on both eyes, but you only cross over on one side. The point here is that all of the visual fields on the right is projected to the left and vice versa. Pretty neat. So a lot of work, as we mentioned, in critical period development to the input on this lateral geniculate. Because you see activity comes from the left eye, right? And activity comes from the right eye. And they project here in this lateral geniculate. So I don't want you to have to memorize the different layers, but they're named with different layers. And if we go to that real fast like this, you can see that these layers from left eye to right eye, they compete for each other. So if you covered the right eye completely, then none of that activity comes in, and then the left eye will take over that neural space. But they noted that this only happens up to a certain point, and then afterwards, if you gave light back, to, say, to the right eye and you gave activity, they would try to compete for that and could start to take over that space. But then after a critical period, there's no more plasticity to it. So this is why they changed the way that they would work with children that had a wandering eye, for example, and they would they instead of waiting for teenage years to fix it, they'll fix it in a young child and shorten up the muscles on one side of their eyeball that controls them so they can focus on the object in front of them, and then these neural pathways will actually grow to the right locations before the critical period has ended, all right, or stops for plasticity. But it's the same with hearing, it's the same with many connections in your brain. And I mentioned about even tactile stuff with your cerebellum, right? The Purkinje cells and little spines that are on it. So if we go back here, really interesting that these then project to the primary visual cortex in the back. And a lot of work has been done in back here. So we're going to show you some figures later on about recordings that were done back here in this region. So just that you have the orientation why we have this brain up here. We talked about the retina already, so I'm not going to talk too much more about it. But except on the quiz, a number of people got confused between omatidia and rods and cones on the vertebrate eye. So remember, when light hits the omatidia in the primary sensory neuron, what happens to that neuron? Does it depolarize or hyperpolarize? It depolarizes. So compound eye is the primary sensory structure, depolarizes. Now, in our eye, if we had an intracellular electrode in here, or we were looking at transmission, when light comes through these cells, it goes through these neurons, right? And then hits the rhodopsin in here, activates that, changes the conformation. Remember, in the dark, you have a dark current, the sodium current, right? Always going into the cell. But when light shines onto it, it stops the dark current, so no more sodium goes in. And remember, E sodium's up high, so what happens if you no longer have sodium coming in? It will go down. It will hyperpolarize. So I know this is odd, but a number of people missed this on the quiz. And you decrease the amount of synaptic transmission from these rods and cones onto the next cell. It decreases the amount of transmission. So I know that's weird because that's kind of opposite thinking from what we've covered in other aspects. But so this is unique about rods and cones. And remember, what are we going to say about C for cones is color, right? People got that one mixed up too. I was hoping to give you these points. So, but remember, cones for color and rods are for more or less just a white intensity or black and white. Okay. I don't want you to have to memorize these kind of different types of cells, but just that this does exist, and I don't want you to know the details of this. It's too much. There's whole courses just on the retina itself. But the idea behind this, the take-home message is the retina is quite complex. It's like a little brain, and there's a lot of integration that goes on with the amacrine cells. Remember, go back here, these amacrine cells and horizontal cells to regulate the output that goes into the optic nerve or to the ganglion cell. So the take-home here, the retina is quite complex. The way it integrates these signals and then the output of the optic nerve. You can record in this optic nerve. You can give different types of signals, right? And some of these, this figure doesn't do you justice, really. Some of these rods and cones have a one-to-one type of connection. Others might have, where you see here, this bipolar cell is actually responding to two, but it could respond to three or four. Those are mostly for the rods out to the side. The cones are more or less a one-to-one, pretty much. Okay, the take-home here is, depending on how you stimulate in the visual field, you can give a light dot and dark surround, or you can give a light surround and a dark dot. They will respond differently. And so here's this ganglion cell that with this type of activity in the front fires multiply, but if you give the light around in the dark spot in the middle, then it hyperpolarizes when that is shined on it. So it's just interesting the way the complexity of the retina responds to surround light and like a center light. All right? It's kind of interesting because it helps us with contrast. Like we talked about red, like if you were wearing a red tie and a white shirt, it looks more red than a red tie on a, say, a darker blue shirt, for example. All right, so that's kind of interesting. So people have recorded from these, and they call them on-center, off-center ganglion cells. And it's interesting because they'll either respond to the on-center light or the off-center light. And it just gives us a very good idea for contrast and also contrast of colors. So it's just kind of interesting. So don't worry about that. Don't go too crazy trying to memorize all that. Just the main take-home points that we covered. And then here's that idea about critical period in development of the nervous system. So this work, a lot of work was done in cats. I know some people are cat lovers, and they probably wouldn't like this. And a lot of work was done on monkeys as well. Then they did this work in dogs and other animals as well. And it's interesting because they discovered so much about how our brain works from this. So what's really interesting, they could put the animal in a stereotaxic head stage, they didn't draw it here, where they're just focusing on something in front of them, and they can give them these different kind of signals, like this. And then they can record back here in the optic, in the occipital cortex in the back of the brain. And their cat's brain structure is very similar to our brain structure. Same with the monkey. And then they found out, oh, that's kind of interesting. If you put a light right there, these cells will fire, but you move over a little bit and you get a different response. Well, anyways, they started doing these different experiments, and some of this they found out by accident. This is Jubel and Wiesel's work when they were at Harvard, working with Stephen Kotler. So they found that if they gave these lights in different orientations, some cells would respond better when the light was in a given orientation. So like this cell, this is a recording from a single cell, would respond best if the light was in this orientation. But if it was in this orientation, it didn't respond at all. So really interesting. But you could go to the next cell over, and you would get the different response. So in the back of our occipital cortex, these different cells responding to light in different perspectives, right? So again, it can really sharpen up how you respond to edges, right? And how that light's coming in. And this is higher processing. This is, you know, fourth order neurons now. So it's really quite interesting. And then they found out if you go back from the retinal regions or the lateral geniculate, remember that's a relay station, then back to the cortex, then you can get these kind of responses. If you go a little deeper in the brain, so not just on the surface, which is really interesting, if you go deeper in the brain, the next layer down in our occipital cortex, those cells respond to the light movement in that direction. Isn't that wild? So they respond to light like that way, but not this way. And so that's pretty cool. Then people realized, well, if it's responding to sensory stimuli in directionally sensitive, the next layers down in our brain, then what about other sensory modalities? What about touch? So they started recording on the sensory cortex for touch. Remember we talked about that, homunculus? And again, you could find, you know, where you touch your hand, for example, that part, that neuron fires. But how is it that you can detect when something moves across your hand? That's interesting. So they found out also the sensory cortex, the next layer deeper in the brain, those are the neurons that respond to the direction of movement, that will respond either that way, but not that way across your hand. That's pretty cool. So really interesting that that same kind of setup is functioning not only in the occipital cortex for vision, but also for tactile. There's so much fun things. The whole course could be a neurophysiology course, but we have to move on. Okay, so that's the idea, is throughout the visual system, neurons have these different functions, and the more complexity of the system, then you could have better responses like the direction of light, intensity of light, contrast of light, edge contrast, and then also color differentiation, right? Contrast of the colors. People have recorded and put on different kinds of ways of looking at these neurons. This is kind of old-fashioned, but you could put on a glucose, that, like a radioisotope glucose, a radio-labeled glucose, for example, or a type of let's just say with this radio type of glucose, radioactive glucose, you can put that on the brain and then stimulate with a set stimulus, and you can see which neurons are active. And then that will go into that cell, and then you can fix it, and you could actually look at the radioactivity, which cells have it. You can now do this with imaging technologies where you don't have to use radioisotopes. You could actually look like with calcium indicators, are sodium indicators, and you can actually image live which cells are active. That's pretty cool. But this pattern, for example, they can actually see that pattern on the brain, and you can actually give them stimuli and look at that occipital cortex, and you can see that same pattern in which cells were active with that stimulus. So this is kind of old-fashioned, but the same ideas, same approaches, basically to look at which neurons are active with imaging technology today. We talked about the owl in our outreach center when we went over there, how cool they are, right, with the two different ears, and how they can detect left and right within millisecond response. So very good about understanding their perception around them because of the different size ears and the timing between left and right ear, that they can process that so well. A lot of people looked at simple animals. I hate to say the crayfish is simple, but crayfish, you know, relatively simple. But even these nudibranchs, and understanding their responses, right? You touch them on the tail, and they have the set pattern of an escape response. Oh, I usually bring in a crayfish, and I forgot to do that. Did we do that before? No, we didn't do that? Oh, but you've seen it kind of in the lab, in a sense, when you cut the tail and you those things were tail flipping. I'll try to bring some in sometime. But what's really fun is that you touch the crayfish on the tail, and it will tail flip, you know, if you touch it like the tail there, it will tail flip away from that stimuli, right? But if you touch it in the nose region or on the antennae, then it flips backwards. It will start going backwards. So you see these two different behaviors like this. Touch it here, and it will go backwards, and that sets this behavior up. Touch it on the tail, and it tail flips up and goes forward. So people were interested in how is it so stereotypic behavioral response. So I mentioned this before, I think. Don Kennedy studied this in the 1970s, and he became the president of Stanford University for like 10 years. And why was it such big news? Because he recorded from each neuron, the sensory neuron, the interneuron, the motor neuron, and showed the neural circuit that could respond to that, or that could elicit this behavior. So he broke down the whole neural circuit to explain the behavior. If you could do that in a simple animal, from neuron to neuron to neuron, then maybe we could start to do that in more complex systems. So it was really the beginning of understanding neural circuits and animal behavior. This is the first animal that was used to understand a complete behavior from neuron to neuron to neuron. So this is why, again, crayfish rule, right? All right. So people study this, and it's quite interesting because what if you had that aggressive crayfish, for example, and you touch that one on the tail, the bully of the group, right? And when you had him as a social hierarchy, and you touch it on the tail, it doesn't tail flip as much as the submissive ones. And you touch the submissive ones, and they'll tail flip more. So then you begin to think, maybe there's something else that's really impacting their nervous system. Maybe there's hormones. Maybe it's that serotonin. You know, something is changing. Pinch the claws off, and you know it autotomizes those. And now it doesn't have the claws. Touch it on the tail. It'll tail flip right away. Whoa! It changed its whole behavior. It's still the same size. It just doesn't have the claws. So what happened, right? So there's a lot of interest in this aspect on the neural circuit with hormones or neuromodulators and how they influence the behavior. Okay. Basically, what they've done is some really interesting work. They've looked at the sensory receptors. Remember, the cell bodies would be like in the telson, right by the hairs or by the cuticle. They could record from those, and they would see that those are always activated every time you do it in a dominant or a submissive animal. The sensory neuron responds the same way, right? It doesn't change its activity. But the way that it connects onto the what's called this lateral giant, for example, this neuron that travels up the ventral nerve cord, that can change depending on if it's a submissive animal or an aggressive animal. So actually, these synapses are plastic, in a sense. They show plasticity. And modulators will work on these synapses. But if you activate the lateral giant, then you pretty much always get the motor neurons to fire, and then it's going to tail flip. So the plasticity, or the synaptic plasticity that changes the behavior, occurs with the sensory neuron onto the interneuron in that animal. So people still to this day, basically students of Don Kennedy's, still work out there in the field to work on these neural circuits. And again, there's a group down in Georgia that does a lot of this work. And there's still people at Stanford that work on this, UCLA that work on this, and around the world, he's put out his neurobiologist to keep studying on this circuit. So crayfish are going to take over. No. All right. Some other really interesting aspects, and I know we kind of jump around, but just so that you see this and you kind of understand it, because there's a lot of research in this system, and it's because, again, it's a simple system. It lives in the dish. It's like the August Crope principle, right? Lives in the dish, minimal saline. You can keep these cells alive for all afternoon, just like the crayfish preparation, if you don't break your electrodes, right? And this is the gastric meal of a lobster, or a crab, or even a crayfish. But a lot of people use crabs and lobsters. And they actually put a camera down in here in the esophagus region, or in this region right here, and they can see these muscles moving back and forth. And they have a certain pattern, right? They'll contract this way or contract that way. And they know the somatogastric ganglion, this ganglion, has a bunch of neurons in there. Depending on which neurons fire, it will either contract in a nice uniform pattern to, you know, crunch the food up this way, or relax it in another and contract the other direction. So people use this to understand neural circuits. The chair of Brandeis University, Eve Marder, she's like a goddess in the field of neuromodulation and synaptic transmission. She studies this quite a bit and looks at how modulators can control this, because it's all modulated with serotonin, but also the amount of food that it has. So stretch receptors send signals into this. The take-home of this, it's another neural circuit that's been modeled. Computational models have been built with this, too, to understand how they can control these muscles in a nice uniform pattern. The idea behind it, again, computational models for prosthetic limbs, robotics, all that kind of work. All right. Then we get to the bird brain, and this is really quite interesting. If anybody's working with birds here, we had a couple of researchers in the biology department that work on it. Dave Westneed, he studies bird behavior. Vinny Cusone studies circadian patterns in birds as well. But the bird brain is phenomenal. When I was starting graduate school in the neuroscience meeting, the first one I went to, I was so excited because they just came out with papers understanding the bird brain that changes from season to season. But not all birds. It was the singing birds, like canaries, zebrafinch, that their brain, certain structures could actually grow. Their brain could grow seasonally and then shrink and then regrow again the next season. It was phenomenal. And they were just beginning to understand that there are these stem cells in the brain that can make new neurons. How can you have an adult brain make new neurons and make those connections and then die back and then do it again the next season? That's weird, right? But it was the beginning of understanding, well, if you could understand that, maybe you could have regeneration and repair with somebody that had an injured brain, right? So it was big news. And so this guy from... he was from Argentina, Notenbaum. He worked on this, and he was at Rockefeller Institute, and it was really interesting. I thought, I'll go see his poster at this meeting. This is many years ago, like 30 years ago. And I thought, okay, I'll go see what he's doing. Maybe there's interesting aspects. You read a paper, and you get all worked up. And you go to this meeting, and you see his students. They got like 50 posters in a row. You think, whoa, they're already on this thing, heavy time. So this has been used for over 30 years, and it's really been a major undertaking. But what's interesting is that they now know the different locations for singing, right? For a bird to sing and also receive it, right? Like a singing canary or a zebra finch. These different connections, and then this actually can change season to season. New neurons are born, and they make the right connections. But it's a complex singing, right? Complex song. But how do they do that? And so this is really quite interesting. So they've noted that now, this is actually a male zebra finch up here, a little cheek. I used to raise them and sell them to pet stores. They're so cool. But anyways, the take-home of this is that they know it's hormonally dependent, in that it's estradiol will... turn into testosterone, right? So you go through this phase to make it. The take-home here, I don't want you to have to memorize which one's working where, but the idea is that it's hormonally driven with estrogen and testosterone in the animal, the singing male pretty much too, but also in the female brain, there's changes. So to learn the song right, these connections have to be made, and then every season this can change. So it's really quite neat versus non-singing birds that don't sing so much for their courtship. They don't show this large change. So animal behavior, really quite neat with the bird brain. New neurons made, right? We were always told when we were students at my age that the brain never regenerates. It was only the nasal neurons that could show stem cells and connect. Then this bird brain work came out, changed the whole field. Everybody jumped on it, studied a bunch of birds. And now that's kind of like phased out, but there's still a lot of people studying aspects. How does it turn on? How does it make a new cell? How does it know to grow to the right target? But it's complex, right, inside the brain. How do you mark those cells? So people went to simpler systems, like Drosophila. And the idea is with Drosophila, you can stain up and have a neuron make a fluorescent marker for you, like GFP, green fluorescent protein, that when that neuron grows, you can actually image it in the fly brain, and you can actually look at those targets and where it's going to. It's too complex, even in the bird brain, to look at those connections and where they're going. So you see how the field progresses. You know the guy that got the Nobel Prize for GFP, green fluorescent protein, that you could express it in cells and it changed developmental biology tremendously. He was on a hike in Oregon about 2 years ago, tripped on a little root and fell off the cliff and died, and he just won the Nobel Prize like the year before. It was crazy, you know. So, in case you don't want to exercise or go on hikes, you've got an excuse, right? You might trip on those. But anyways, that was really sad because it was two brothers. They were twins, I think. And one was big-time calcium imager, and the other one was really studying a lot with the hippocampus work, and they developed a lot of these dyes together that revolutionized biology, really. All right, you might have seen this kind of figure in or talked about montane voles and prairie voles in ecology. Did you talk about them yet? Does anybody remember talking about them in ecology? No? Shucks. Okay. We used to be really good things in ecology with animal behavior so much. But this is really interesting because this relates to a lot with human behavior as well. People have now shown it does. But the montane vole and the prairie vole, and you look at the left-hand side here, it says affinitive behavior, grooming behavior, basically. And they look at the grooming behavior either with a partner or maybe even with their offspring, okay? So lots of different studies that were done with this grooming behavior, cleaning the other one up, right? And the montane voles really didn't do much of it, but the prairie voles do quite a bit. And they looked at the arginine vasopressin levels in these two animals. And they could look at it by either injecting cerebral spinal fluid, so you either put cerebral spinal fluid in there, or you put arginine vasopressin. And you could see the montane vole really didn't respond any different. Prairie vole responded quite a bit, right, if you get arginine vasopressin. So why use cerebral spinal fluid? It's a control, right? So just a control. All right, so for like the injection and all the stress. But the prairie vole responded quite a bit. And why would they use this? They had found in the animals that there were differences in the arginine vasopressin levels. But not only that, there were differences in the receptors for them. So how to test if it's really arginine vasopressin doing it, or maybe the receptor expression. So then you take mice that don't show this different behavior. You take your wild-type mice, do the same experiment, and then this transgenic mice, where you overexpress the receptor for arginine vasopressin. If you overexpress the receptor for arginine vasopressin, you inject arginine vasopressin, they increase their grooming behavior. So now think of the human connection. Mothers, for example, affinitive to their baby, right? They now think that that might have a part of the receptivity of actually responding to that infant, or wanting to groom, or to be social. You might have heard of oxytocin being the bonding hormone, right? Because you can have, and a lot of these studies were done with this, you can have two mice together, a female and a male mouse, separated in a, you know, with a screen between the two of them. Did you talk about this in ecology, psychology? Don't talk about psychology either. It's kind of interesting, because you could take the female and the male, so the female's on the right hand over here, and they can smell each other, and then they can pair the male with the female. And the female might show some sensitivity to the male, right? Okay, but then if you inject the female with oxytocin, every time it's paired with a particular male, let's call it male number two, and then when it's paired with male number one, you don't inject oxytocin, but only when it's paired with number two, and you wait in between pairing them. And now you put them together. And now the female would be more receptive to the number two when it received oxytocin than when it wasn't receiving oxytocin to male number one. So they call that the bonding hormone. How does that relate? Well, we're going to get into endocrine next, but with milk letdown, for example, suckling of a child on the breast of a mother releases oxytocin. So that would increase what? The bonding behavior, right? So this is why some people really advocate breastfeeding for the infant for one reason, because it might increase the bonding that goes on with the infant. So it's pretty well documented in other animals, but you know, you can think of this with human connection as well. So interesting to think about. People made a lot of jokes with this too about maybe in the bar I'll slip the girl oxytocin. That's a bad joke, right? Now, these days you don't want to do that. But maybe oxytocin could be a factor with human behavior. So this is kind of things to think about. All right? So that's the way it goes. And then, you know, both ways, right? So that's interesting. Let's go into wrap this chapter up about the parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system. We talked about this before, right? The autonomic nervous system. Okay, so the central brain and then the spinal cord. Motor neurons, didn't we talk about this? Yes, okay. I just want to make sure. So we're going to go through this kind of quickly. Somatic system, right? Skeletal muscles. The autonomic system, sympathetic, parasympathetic system, and then we talk about sensory input into the central nervous system. And if you look at that, it's paired throughout the animal kingdom pretty much. Even invertebrates, right? Even invertebrates show a response to a predator, like we talked about with the crayfish. And even like a moth that's flying, if it hears a sound, the echolation of the bat, for example, will fold its wings and dive down. You can even trick them just with a speaker. So what are these kind of innate type of behaviors, these responses? But you can also measure hormones are released with that kind of stress, like epinephrine in us. Serotonin seems to be what raises invertebrates with stress, such as a fear response. But the idea is that our sympathetic nervous system is very similar all throughout the vertebrates, down to fish, amphibians, reptiles, and people look at this even in the invertebrates to understand how is it that these circuits work in controlling a behavior so fast, because that would be survival of the species, right? The Russians worked on this initially. They are actually the founders of a lot of the understanding the autonomic nervous system, and there's a lot of emphasis on the structure, comparative structures in Russian neurobiology. If you look at the human brain, you can see that the sympathetic trunk, remember, thoracic lumbar region, cranial sacral was what? Parasympathetic. Cranial sacral, thoracic lumbar, sympathetic. All right. And then how do they project to the different organs? And our body, just like what we talked about with annelids and planaria and other animals, we're segmental also. So like what we talked about, when you get shingles, you could draw a line right down the middle of a person if they have shingles, and they'll get a rash just in that band. People used to think a long time ago that they were like possessed with evil spirits and all that stuff, and there's lots of weird things in the literature. But now that we know the anatomy well, right, we can explain that. So it's really quite interesting. We saw this over in the outreach center before, and I mentioned how difficult that was to see that spinal cord in the outreach center. Think about it. They had to break all these bones out to be able to dissect that spinal cord out that we saw in the outreach center, and that's a long, tedious process. And they kept the dorsal root ganglion that are right here, right, intact so you could see them. And I guess I should have pointed out more on that spinal cord. You could see on some of the region the sympathetic chain ganglion that was still intact as well. Okay, so just to kind of get you in the mindset again, that cross-section of the spinal cord, dorsal root ganglion comes in, dorsal horn, ventral horn, motor output, right? But you have this little group right here where the neurons to the sympathetic nervous system, the cell bodies are right here, and they come out, and they can go this way and then to the sympathetic chain ganglion. So this is kind of interesting. Later, if you're in med school or PA or PT and you take and they give you cross sections of the spinal cord, this is a good indication. You can actually look at the spinal cord and you can say, I'm in the thoracic lumbar region because I see this little protuberance in the gray matter right there. And that gives you a good indication where that cross section is from. Kind of interesting. All right. How many cranial nerves do we have? 12, right. Okay, 12 cranial nerves. How many cranial nerves does a bird have? 12. How many cranial nerves does a sheep brain have? 12. How many cranial nerves does a lizard have? 12. Okay, you get the idea, right? And this is why in high school you might have dissected a sheep brain, for example. You look at the cranial nerves and how they project to the different regions. I don't want you to have to memorize this. Older, you might have seen it on some of the test bank. Old profs had you memorize this, and there's certain mnemonics, you know, like a saying that you can have to memorize that if you want to. You might need it for a standardized test, so if you're taking MCAT or something, they might have you actually know these nerves. But it's really interesting. They're always named in the same order. This is why you can carry these out through a human brain to a snake brain, and you can actually look at the 12 cranial nerves and find them pretty easily. olfaction right to the nose, optic nerve, right, with the vision system, ocular motor controls the eye movement, trochlear the fourth, trigeminal the face, right, abducens again for the eye control, and facial nerves, mostly muscles to control. Vestibular cochlear, this is what we talked about with the inner ear, right, for example. Both is in there. The semicircular canals as well as hearing, as well as the utriculus and sacculus. So this is really important for that equilibrium sense as well as hearing and static position. Then the pharyngeal, like the pharynx, right? Vagal nerve off to the heart. Spinal accessory, 11 is on your back, of your back of your neck, back muscles, and the hypoglossal to your tongue region. So interesting to kind of know those and what they do. I don't want you to memorize which cranial nerve is what, but that there are 12. You should know that. And that the one that we're going to spend a little more time on is the vagal nerve. So the vagal nerve goes to your heart, right? And so one of the early transmitters discovered was called vagal stuff. In a German group, they called it vagal stuff, right? Because they knew the cranial nerve, 10, vagal nerve. They didn't know what the transmitter was, but if they stimulated it, it would change the heart. And so it was really interesting. So they called it stuff, basically vagal stuff. And so they knew that they could stimulate that vagal nerve and the heart would slow down. Well, they then took that fluid around the heart that they were stimulating, like in a frog, after stimulating the nerve a lot, they took that fluid away and put it on another animal's heart that was beating, and it would slow down. So they knew that something was released. And then they later discovered it was the acetylcholine. So it's interesting how that vagal nerve works on controlling the heart. The point about here on these colored diagrams, you see these regions, like for vision and olfaction and motor control. It's the same general anatomy throughout the vertebrates, right? From fish to us, the same general arrangement. And so you can go through the fish brain. You can see the cerebellum's becoming more developed, but they don't have little fingers like we do. And then you go through the frog. It's not too developed there. They're not using their digits too much. And then you get into the bird, and I got wings to control, right? And feet, and land on those little telephone wires. And then you get into the human, and we're very complex, like for the cerebellum. And that controls your coordination, for example. All right, so it's the same kind of region, same function. The take-home here is that you can understand it, our brain, from looking at comparative aspects, because the same kind of regions fit. Of course, then we have more processing that goes on. Another big point to recall is that this brainstem region right here, then you got off the spinal cord right here, this brainstem region, the different regions in there to control motor output are for respiration, are for hormonal release like the hypothalamus. That is no different in your brain than the bird brain, than the reptile brain. It's basically the same structure in the brainstem. You can go into the reptile brain and you can say that region is for pH control. That region controls respiration. That region controls, you know, motor output. It's that well stereotyped. So the brainstem is really this older system, and then you see that these have evolved differently for whatever function that they might use. We went through kind of this before with the lab that we had before with the sensory and motor cortex. It's the same idea, different regions from simpler animals all the way up to us hold that same kind of anatomy. Okay, we talked about the homunculus before when we did their two-point discrimination and aspects with that, so try to remember that. We saw those figures before, something like that I showed you at the outreach center. Remember the star-nosed mole was really quite neat, and the projections on the brain with that. So let's think a little bit more about the sympathetic system in the autonomic system. You know, fight or flight response, right? Are you going to, you know, back down? Are you going to get scared? You might not run, but your heart rate, you know, might increase, right? You might not show that behavioral response, but you're definitely internally responding. This is what happens when you come back or you find out you have a quiz that day in class and you forgot it. All right. So this is, and this is not in your textbook, but I bring this up because this is now on standardized exams. and it's abbreviated GAS, this general adaptation syndrome. And you can think of yourselves fitting in this, right? College life. It's constant stress. And people are now worried about this, even in zoo animals, for example, in the cages, and this constant stress, but also with people that are under stress all the time, working all the time, for example, or in a stressful situation all the time, you know, in the military or first responders that they're working all the time. So first you get this alarming mobilization stage. So what happens if you get stressed right away? You're going to get glucose levels up, right? Maybe cortisol released to get your glucose levels up. And you're going to respond and be able to function quickly. But then, you know, you kind of get used to that, right? In that mode, that stress that's going on. It's like studying for your exams at midterm. You just keep getting them, right? And you're kind of like, I can deal with it. But then they threw in another exam and that quiz and then that paper and then that newspaper article you have to write tonight. Now, it's like you are just exhausted, right? You just can't wait for spring break. So you're in that exhaustion stage. But this is really even more severe. Some of it's constantly stressed. So what's going to happen at that point? You know, these first points were really good. Maybe you could respond to that stressor. But if you have cortisol released all the time, what does that cortisol do? It can actually break down muscle mass. It can break down tissue in your body to raise that glucose levels up or to keep getting that energy. So then that becomes detrimental, right? That's not going to be good for the whole animal. So you end up with these negative consequences of constant stress. Just have more caffeine is my answer. Okay. So just remember this. I kind of joke about it, but remember this in the sense, because if you're taking standardized exams, that might appear nowadays. All right, so GAS syndrome, and think of the autonomic nervous system, the sympathetic nervous system, just continually working to exhaustion stage. Okay. So on there in the text, there's a number of tables that we're looking at, but don't stress out about this. You know this already. You know what happens to you if you're stressed, right? A sympathetic response versus a relaxed state. So what happens when you're stressed? Your heart rate goes up. In a relaxed state, your heart rate is more, you know, relaxed. What's going to happen to, where do those hormones come from when you're in a stressed state? And I think we all probably have heard of the adrenal gland, right? But the adrenal medulla, that's the inside part of the adrenal gland. When we get to hormones, we'll talk more about hormone chapter, we'll talk more about the adrenal gland, but you have two regions, the cortex and the inside region called the medulla. The medulla is the part that releases epinephrine and norepinephrine. Okay, so stimulating this, parasympathetic, no real effect, decrease the activity. What happens when you get stressed out? You might sweat, right? Your palms sweat, your feet sweat, right? You have to give a seminar in 426 or 425, right? And you're wondering why your feet, you know, now feel like your shoes are all wet because you're sweating, right? And that, you can think of that with sweating as well. Sympathetic, of course, you increase your heart rate, right? And that sympathetic, we mentioned the nerves. Not only do you release epinephrine from your adrenal glands, but you have sympathetic nerves directly onto the heart. And that can increase the force of contraction. And epinephrine release can actually increase your heart rate. Okay, and you put epinephrine on your frog hearts, right? Right? Yeah? Did you? Something? Okay. So you get the idea of that. All right. So don't try to memorize everything in here. Just get the main points. And then when we talk about the endocrine chapter, that'll come together with this too, because epinephrine increasing and cortisol levels increasing to raise glucose levels. All right. But you might just want to look through there to kind of get an idea. So here's a really nice figure to kind of remember. And ways to think about this is sympathetic and parasympathetic. So there's a lot to this figure, actually, and we're going to go over it a little bit more and more. But you want to be able to write this down with a blank piece of paper and really get this down pat. Because when you think about the pharmacology world out there, all the pharmaceutical companies, this is a billion-dollar industry, which they work on to try to reduce stress, for example, or GI function, or regulate your heart rate, right, or hypertension. A lot has to do with this system right here that we're talking about. So the sympathetic, where does it come from? Thoracic lumbar, right? Sympathetic, thoracic lumbar. Look at the neurotransmitters here. Acetylcholine is the preganglionic. So this is to the ganglion before it reaches the target, right? And then, so this is what's called preganglionic, and this is postganglionic. And then the postganglionic neuron onto the, say, the smooth muscle are the GI tract, for example, norepinephrine. So norepinephrine. So these are adrenergic receptors that we're going to talk about here. Now the parasympathetic, remember what we talked about, para, cranial sacral, a pair, right? Cranial sacral, a pair. But also think of pair, the two neurotransmitter regions. It's a pair of acetylcholine. Pair, acetylcholine and acetylcholine. Acetylcholine and acetylcholine, okay? So you can think of parasympathetic, paracetylcholine, acetylcholine, cranial sacral. All right? That might help to try to remember this. Sometimes on standardized exams, and our old test questions had this too, in general, not always the case, but in general, the preganglionic is longer in the parasympathetic than in the sympathetic. And the postganglionic in the parasympathetic is shorter, and it's longer in the sympathetic. Well, think about it. The parasympathetic, cranial sacral, and you have to go to some tissue in the middle, we get this long preganglionic and then a short postganglionic. Where the sympathetic, let's say it's thoracic lumbar, it's going to go over to the heart, short distance, right? So kind of a shorter and then maybe a longer on the other aspect. It might be hard to remember this, but you can kind of get the idea. All right, so if we look at the sympathetic and the parasympathetic, so pair, cranial sacral, thoracic lumbar for the sympathetic, in general, preganglionic and postganglionic fibers, okay? But it doesn't always hold. I try to get away from that test question these days on the length of those, but the general idea, we should know the transmitters, we should know the regions that they come from, and the general functions on the tissue, such as heart rate or to your GI tract. When you're in a relaxed state is when you're digesting, right? Relax and digestion. When you're in a stress state, you're not worried about digestion. Okay. So here's the other part to remember. Are the receptors, because this is where the billion-dollar industry is in the pharmaceutical world, trying to selectively hit these receptors one way or the other. So the sympathetic, preganglionic, this can be a little confusing, is acetylcholine, right? Just like it is in the parasympathetic is acetylcholine also. But remember, parasympathetic is acetylcholine. So here's the postganglionic, preganglionic. Well, what about the receptor subtypes? This is where the confusing comes in. The somatic system, remember your skeletal muscles? What is that? Those are nicotinic, right? Onto your skeletal muscles. But now we have the sympathetic, the parasympathetic, the first preganglionic neurons, they're all nicotinic in both, sympathetic and parasympathetic. But now you get to the parasympathetic, paracetylcholine, acetylcholine, but its target out to the smooth muscle, for example, is not nicotinic. It's muscarinic. Right? It's muscarinic. So people get confused this all the time with skeletal muscles. So try not to get this confused. The target on the target tissue with the parasympathetic, even though it's acetylcholine, they're muscarinic receptors. Metabotropic receptors work through second messenger cascades. Okay, so that's a big point to try to remember. Now the sympathetic nervous system, as you go through here, remember, nicotinic, the first ganglionic, postganglionic onto the target tissue, alpha and beta adrenergic receptors. This was very confusing for many years in the literature because you could stimulate the sympathetic, and in some blood vessels, they had contraction. In other blood vessels, they got relaxation. What on earth is going on? It wasn't giving the same response to blood vessels, right? But it depended which blood vessels. Then they finally realized there are different receptor subtypes. There's the alpha adrenergic receptors, and there's the beta adrenergic receptors. And the alpha adrenergic receptors, if this tissue had alpha adrenergic receptors, it would contract. And if this tissue had beta adrenergic receptors, it would relax. But the same neurotransmitter and the same neurons that, you're activating the system. So it was very confusing. This was a big breakthrough when they found out it was the receptors. And this points to that point again. It's not the neurotransmitter. It's the receptors that mediate the response. So these two different receptors give different responses. Wow. I'm only one lecture behind on endocrine. But anyways, so we won't go anymore. If you haven't picked up your quiz, I have those up here. Have fun over spring break. Study, 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 study. If you have any questions, give a holler. This is a great time to go through your test bank, right? and really cover up your answers. Just read the question, see if you understand the question, and then, you know, try to write. You might want to try to write your answers out. The next test is a doozy, right? A lot of open response questions, a lot of material.
Will you be here over spring break? Yes. All right, perfect. I'd love to meet with you and talk.
Yeah, sure. Did you get yours?
Yeah, I got mine already. I noticed that for what we have on the website, you have exams 2 and 3, and then there's 4 for the final exam. But are we treating this next exam only as a midterm?
No, there's only 3 exams total.
Okay.
First, second, and then the final.
Okay, so do we combine...
You mean this? Say this is like long exams.
At the very top, you have posted...
Oh, those are... That was just... These are old exams.
Yeah.
From another class.
What...
We don't have 4 exams in this class.
Okay, but like the material that would be on test 2 and 3, could we see that
on the
next?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
That's
why
saying.
This is really a long.
Yeah, that's what I was.
Heavy exam.
Thank you.
Uh huh. I know what you want. You want this?
Yes.
There you go.
Thank you.
Great. Hi. How are you?
Good.
Choi, right?
Yeah. Dang. Let's stop. J-A-N.
Is this you?
No.
The last name is Jay?
Yeah.
Oh, Jay Jones. Did you take the quiz? Jay? Oh, yeah, here you are. Okay, good. Thanks. Mm-hmm. Did we get this?
Michael.
Hi. Yeah,
so, with the nicotine, mm-hmm. the maximum force during tetanus, mm-hmm. it, like, decreased